chosen people to roam for some coin and the right to prance about in his spangled garments. His very existence was an insult to God. It was a blight upon the entire land. It had to be wiped away. Chapter 2. King of the Jews. In the years of tumult that followed the Roman occupation of Judea, as Rome became enmeshed in a debilitating civil war between Pompey Magnus and his erstwhile ally Julius Caesar, even while remnants of the Hasmonean dynasty continued vying for the favors of both men, the situation for the Jewish farmers and peasants who harrowed and sowed God's land steadily worsened. The small family farms that for centuries had served as the primary basis of the rural economy were gradually swallowed up by large estates administered by landed aristocracies flush with freshly minted Roman coins. Rapid urbanization under Roman rule fueled mass internal migration from the countryside to the cities. The agriculture that had once sustained the meager village populations was now almost wholly focused on feeding the engorged urban centers, leaving the rural peasants hungry and destitute. The peasantry was not only obligated to continue paying their taxes and their tithes to the temple priesthood, they were now forced to pay a heavy tribute to Rome. For farmers, the total could amount to nearly half their annual yield. At the same time, successive droughts had left large swaths of the countryside fallow and in ruin, as much of the Jewish peasantry was reduced to slavery. Those who managed to remain on their wasted fields often had no choice but to borrow heavily from the landed aristocracy, and at exorbitant interest rates. Never mind that Jewish law forbade the charging of interest on loans, the massive fines that were levied on the poor for late payments had basically the same effect. In any case, the landed aristocracy expected the peasants to default on their loans. They were banking on it. For if the loan was not promptly and fully repaid, the peasant's land could be confiscated, and the peasant kept on the farm as a tenant, toiling on behalf of its new owner. Within a few years of the Roman conquest of Jerusalem, an entire crop of landless peasants found themselves stripped of their property, with no way to feed themselves or their families. Many of these peasants immigrated to the cities to find work. But in Galilee, a handful of displaced farmers and landowners exchanged their plows for swords and began fighting back against those they deemed responsible for their woes. From their hiding places in the caves and grottos of the Galilean countryside, these peasant warriors launched a wave of attacks against the Jewish aristocracy and the agents of the Roman Republic. They roamed through the provinces, gathering to themselves those in distress, those who were dispossessed and mired in debt. Like Jewish Robin Hoods, they robbed the rich and, on occasion, gave to the poor. To the faithful, these peasant gangs were nothing less than the physical embodiment of the anger and suffering of the poor. They were heroes, symbols of righteous zeal against Roman aggression, dispensers of divine justice to the traitorous Jews. The Romans had a different word for them. They called them lestae, bandits. Bandit was the generic term for any rebel or insurrectionist who employed armed violence either against Rome or against the Jewish collaborators. To the Romans, the word bandit was synonymous with thief or rabble-rouser. But these were no common criminals. The bandits represented the first stirrings of what would become a nationalist resistance movement against the Roman occupation. This may have been a peasant revolt. The bandit gangs hailed from impoverished villages like Emmaus, Beth Horon, and Bethlehem. But it was something else, too. The bandits claimed to be agents of God's retribution. They cloaked their leaders in the emblems of biblical kings and heroes, and presented their actions as a prelude for the restoration of God's kingdom on earth. The bandits tapped into the widespread apocalyptic expectation that had gripped the Jews of Palestine in the wake of the Roman invasion. One of the most fearsome of all the bandits, the charismatic bandit chief Hezekiah, openly declared himself to be the Messiah, the promised one who would restore the Jews to glory. Messiah means anointed one. The title alludes to the practice of pouring or smearing oil on someone charged with divine office, a king like Saul or David or Solomon, a priest like Aaron and his sons who were consecrated to do God's work, a prophet like Isaiah or Elisha who bore a special relationship with God, an intimacy that comes with being designated God's representative on earth. The principal task of the Messiah, who was popularly believed to be the descendant of King David, was to rebuild David's kingdom and reestablish the nation of Israel. Thus, to call oneself the Messiah at the time of the Roman occupation was tantamount to declaring war on Rome. Indeed, the day would come when these angry bands of peasant gangs would form the backbone of an apocalyptic army of zealous revolutionaries that would force the Romans to flee Jerusalem in humiliation. In those early years of the occupation, however, the bandits were little more than a nuisance. Still, they needed to be stopped. Someone had to restore order in the countryside. That someone turned out to be a clever young Jewish nobleman from Idumea named Herod. Herod's father, Antipater, had the good fortune of being on the right side in the civil war between Pompey Magnus and Julius Caesar. Caesar rewarded Antipater for his loyalty by granting him Roman citizenship in 48 BCE and giving him administrative powers on behalf of Rome over all of Judea. Before his death a few years later, Antipater cemented his position among the Jews by appointing his sons Phasael and Herod as governors over Jerusalem and Galilee, respectively. Herod was probably only 15 years old at the time, but he immediately distinguished himself as an effective leader and energetic supporter of Rome by launching a bloody crusade against the bandit gangs. He even captured the bandit chief Hezekiah and cut off his head, putting an end, temporarily, to the bandit menace. While Herod was clearing Galilee of the bandit gangs, Antigonus, the son of Aristobulus, who had lost the throne and the high priesthood to his brother Hyrcanus after the Roman invasion, was stirring up trouble in Jerusalem. With the help of Rome's avowed enemies, the Parthians, Antigonus besieged the holy city in 40 BCE, taking both the high priest Hyrcanus and Herod's brother Phasael prisoner. Hyrcanus was mutilated, rendering him ineligible, according to Jewish law, to serve any longer as high priest. Herod's brother Phasael committed suicide while in captivity. The Roman Senate determined that the most effective way to retake Jerusalem from Parthian control was to make Herod its client king and let him accomplish the task on Rome's behalf. The naming of client kings was standard practice during the early years of the Roman Empire, allowing Rome to expand its borders without expending valuable resources administering conquered provinces directly. In 37 BCE, Herod marched to Jerusalem with a massive Roman army under his command. He expelled the Parthian forces from the city and wiped out the remnants of the Hasmonean dynasty. In recognition of his services, Rome named Herod King of the Jews, granting him a kingdom that would ultimately grow larger than that of King Solomon. Herod's was a profligate and tyrannical rule, marked by farcical excess and bestial acts of cruelty. He was ruthless to his enemies and tolerated no hint of revolt from the Jews under his reign. Upon ascending the throne, he massacred nearly every member of the Sanhedrin and replaced the temple priests with a claque of fawning admirers who purchased their positions directly from him. This act effectively neutered the political influence of the temple and redistributed power to a new class of Jews whose reliance on the favors of the king transformed them into a sort of nouveau riche aristocracy. Herod's penchant for violence and his highly publicized domestic disputes, which bordered on the burlesque, led him to execute so many members of his own family that Caesar Augustus once famously quipped, "I would rather be Herod's pig than his son." In truth, being king of the Jews in Herod's time was no enviable task. There were, according to Josephus, 24 fractious Jewish sects in and around Jerusalem. Although none enjoyed unfettered dominance over the others, three sects, or rather schools, were particularly influential in shaping Jewish thought at the time. The Pharisees, who were primarily lower and middle class rabbis and scholars who interpreted the laws for the masses, the Sadducees, more conservative and, with regard to Rome, more accommodating priests from wealthier landowning families, and the Essenes, a predominantly priestly movement that separated itself from the authority of the temple and made its base on a barren hilltop in the Dead Sea Valley called Qumran. Charged with pacifying and administrating an unruly and heterogeneous population of Jews, Greeks, Samaritans, Syrians, and Arabs, all of whom hated him more than they hated each other, Herod did a masterful job of maintaining order on behalf of Rome. His reign ushered in an era of political stability among the Jews that had not been seen for centuries. He initiated a monumental building and public works project that employed tens of thousands of peasants and day laborers, permanently changing the physical landscape of Jerusalem. He built markets and theaters, palaces and ports, all modeled on the classic Hellenic style. To pay for his colossal construction projects, and to satisfy his own extravagance, Herod imposed a crushing tax rate upon his subjects, from which he continued to dispatch a hefty tribute to Rome, and with pleasure, as an expression of his esteem for his Roman masters. Herod was not just the emperor's client king. He was a close and personal friend, a loyal citizen of the Republic, who wanted more than to emulate Rome. He wanted to remake it in the sands of Judea. He instituted a forced Hellenization program upon the Jews, bringing gymnasia, Greek amphitheaters, and Roman baths to Jerusalem. He made Greek the language of his court and minted coins bearing Greek letters and pagan insignia. Yet Herod was also a Jew, and as such, he understood the importance of appealing to the religious sensibilities of his subjects. That is why he embarked on his most ambitious project, the rebuilding and expansion of the Temple of Jerusalem. It was Herod who had the temple raised on a platform atop Mount Moriah, the highest point in the city, and embellished with wide Roman colonnades and towering marble columns that gleamed in the sun. Herod's temple was meant to impress his patrons in Rome, but he also wanted to please his fellow Jews, many of whom did not consider the King of the Jews to be himself a Jew. Herod was a convert, after all. His mother was an Arab. His people, the Idumeans, had come to Judaism only a generation or two earlier. The rebuilding of the temple was for Herod not only a means of solidifying his political dominance, it was a desperate plea for acceptance by his Jewish subjects. It did not work. Despite the rebuilding of the temple, Herod's unabashed Hellenism and his aggressive attempts to Romanize Jerusalem enraged pious Jews, who seemed to never have ceased viewing their king as a slave to foreign masters and a devotee of foreign gods. Not even the temple, the supreme symbol of Jewish identity, could mask Herod's infatuation with Rome. Shortly before its completion, Herod placed a golden eagle, the sign of Roman dominion, over its main portal, and forced his hand-picked high priest to offer two sacrifices a day on behalf of Caesar Augustus as the Son of God. Nevertheless, it is a sign of how firmly Herod held his kingdom in his grip that the general odium of the Jews toward his reign never rose to the level of insurrection, at least not in his lifetime. When Herod the Great died in 4 BCE, Augustus split his realm among his three sons. Archelaus was given Judea, Samaria, and Idumea. Herod Antipas, known as the Fox, reigned over Galilee and Perea, a region in the Transjordan northeast of the Dead Sea. And Philip was handed control over Gaulonitis, modern-day Golan, and the lands northeast of the Sea of Galilee. None of Herod's three sons were given the title of king. Antipas and Philip were each named Tetrarch, meaning ruler of a quarter, and Archelaus was named Ethnarch, or ruler of a people. Both titles were deliberately meant to signal the end of unified kingship over the Jews. The division of Herod's kingdom proved a disaster for Rome, as the dam of anger and resentment that had been built during his long and oppressive reign burst into a flood of riots and violent protests that his nebbish sons, dulled by a life of idleness and languor, could hardly contain. The rioters burned down one of Herod's palaces on the Jordan River. Twice the temple itself was overrun, first during Passover, then again at Shavuot, or the Festival of Weeks. In the countryside, the bandit gangs that Herod had beaten into submission once again began tearing through Galilee, slaughtering the former king's associates. In Idumea, Herod's home region, 2,000 of his soldiers mutinied. Even Herod's allies, including his own cousin Achiab, joined the rebellion. These uprisings were no doubt fueled by the messianic expectations of the Jews. In Perea, a former slave of Herod's, an imposing giant of a man named Simon, crowned himself Messiah and rallied together a group of bandits to plunder the royal palaces at Jericho. The rebellion ended when Simon was captured and beheaded. A short while later, another messianic aspirant, a poor shepherd boy named Athronges, placed a crown upon his head and launched a foolhardy attack against Roman forces. He too was caught and executed. The chaos and bloodshed continued unabated until Caesar Augustus finally ordered his own troops into Judea to put an end to the uprising. Although the emperor allowed Philip and Antipas to remain in their posts, he sent Archelaus into exile, placed Jerusalem under a Roman governor, and in the year 6 CE transformed all of Judea into a province ruled directly by Rome. There would be no more semi-independence, no more client kings, no more king of the Jews. Jerusalem now belonged wholly to Rome. According to tradition, Herod the Great died on the eve of Passover in 4 BCE, at the ripe age of 70, having reigned over the Jews for 37 years. Josephus writes that on the day of Herod's death, there was an eclipse of the moon, an inauspicious sign, perhaps presaging the tumult that would follow. There is, of course, another tradition told about the demise of Herod the Great, that sometime between his death in 4 BCE and the Roman takeover of Jerusalem in 6 CE, in an obscure hillside village in Galilee, a child was born who would one day claim for himself Herod's mantle as king of the Jews. Chapter 3. You know where I am from. Ancient Nazareth rests on the jagged brow of a windy hilltop in Lower Galilee. No more than 100 Jewish families live in this tiny village. There are no roads, no public buildings. There is no synagogue. The villagers share a single well from which to draw fresh water. A single bath, fed by a trickle of rainfall captured and stored in underground cisterns, serves the entire population. It is a village of mostly illiterate peasants, farmers, and day laborers, a place that does not exist on any map. The homes in Nazareth are simple affairs, a single windowless room divided in two, one room for the family, the other for the livestock, made of whitewashed mud and stone and crowned with a flat-topped roof where the householders gather to pray, where they lay out their wash to dry, where they take their meals on temperate evenings, and where, in the hot summer months, they roll out their dusty mats and sleep. The lucky inhabitants have a courtyard and a tiny patch of soil to grow vegetables, for no matter their occupation or skill, every Nazarene is a farmer. The peasants who called this secluded village home are, without exception, cultivators of the land. It is agriculture that feeds and sustains the meager population. Everyone raises their own livestock, everyone plants their own crops, a bit of barley, some wheat, a few stalks of millet and oats. The manure collected from the animals feeds the earth, which in turn feeds the villagers, who then feed the livestock. Self-sufficiency is the rule. The hillside hamlet of Nazareth is so small, so obscure, that its name does not appear in any ancient Jewish source before the 3rd century CE, not in the Hebrew Bible, not in the Talmud, not in the Midrash, not in Josephus. It is, in short, an inconsequential and utterly forgettable place. It is also the city in which Jesus was likely born and raised. That he came from this tightly enclosed village of a few hundred impoverished Jews may very well be the only fact concerning Jesus' childhood about which we can be fairly confident. So identified was Jesus with Nazareth that he was known throughout his life simply as the Nazarene. Considering how common a first name Jesus was, the city of his birth became his principal sobriquet. It was the one thing about which everyone who knew him, his friends and his enemies alike, seemed to agree. Why then do Matthew and Luke, and only Matthew and Luke, claim that Jesus was born not in Nazareth, but in Bethlehem, even though the name Bethlehem does not appear anywhere else in the entire New Testament, not even anywhere else in Matthew or Luke, both of which repeatedly refer to Jesus as the Nazarene, save for a single verse in the Gospel of John. The answer may be found in that verse from John, chapter 7, verse 42. It was, the evangelist writes, early in Jesus' ministry. Up to this point, Jesus had, for the most part, restricted himself to preaching his message to the poor farmers and fishermen of Galilee, his friends and neighbors. But now that the Feast of Tabernacles had arrived, Jesus' family urged him to travel with them to Judea to celebrate the joyous harvest festival together and to reveal himself to the masses. "Come," they say, "show yourself to the world." Jesus refuses. "You go," he tells them. "I am not going to this festival. It is not yet my time." Jesus' family leave him behind and head off to Judea together. Yet, unbeknownst to them, Jesus decides to follow them down to Judea after all, if for no other reason than to secretly roam through the assembled crowd and hear what people are saying about him. "He is a good man," someone whispers. "No, he is leading the people astray," says another. Sometime later, after Jesus has revealed himself to the crowd, a few begin to make guesses about his identity. "Surely he is a prophet." And then someone finally says it. Everyone is clearly thinking it. How could they not be, what with Jesus standing tall amid the crowd declaring, "Let he who thirsts come to me and drink"? How are they to understand such heretical words? Who else would dare say such a thing openly and within earshot of the scribes and the teachers of the law, many of whom, we are told, would like nothing more than to silence and arrest this irksome preacher? This man is the Messiah. This is no simple declaration. It is, in fact, an act of treason. In first century Palestine, simply saying the words, "This is the Messiah," aloud and in public, can be a criminal offense, punishable by crucifixion. True, the Jews of Jesus' time had somewhat conflicting views about the role and function of the Messiah, fed by a score of messianic traditions and popular folktales that were floating around the Holy Land. Some believed the Messiah would be a restorative figure who would return the Jews to their previous position of power and glory. Others viewed the Messiah in more apocalyptic and utopian terms, as someone who would annihilate the present world and build a new, more just world upon its ruins. There were those who thought the Messiah would be a king, and those who thought he'd be a priest. The Essenes apparently awaited two separate messiahs, one kingly, the other priestly, though most Jews thought of the Messiah as possessing a combination of both traits. Nevertheless, among the crowd of Jews gathered for the Feast of Tabernacles, there seems to have been a fair consensus about who the Messiah is supposed to be and what the Messiah is supposed to do. He is the descendant of King David. He comes to restore Israel, to free the Jews from the yoke of occupation, and to establish God's rule in Jerusalem. To call Jesus the Messiah, therefore, is to place him inexorably upon a path already well trodden by a host of failed messiahs who came before him toward conflict, revolution, and war against the prevailing powers. Where that path would ultimately lead, no one at the festival could know for sure, but there was some sense of where the path must begin. "Does not the scripture say that the Messiah is of David's seed?" someone in the crowd asks. "That he comes from the village where David lived? From Bethlehem?" "But we know where this man comes from," claims another. Indeed, the crowd seems to know Jesus well. They know his brothers, who are there with him. His entire family is present. They travel to the festival together from their home in Galilee, from Nazareth. "Look into it," says a Pharisee with the confidence that comes from a lifetime of scrutinizing the scriptures. "You will see, the prophet does not come out of Galilee." Jesus does not dispute their claim. "Yes, you all know me," he admits, "and you know where I am from." Instead, he deflects the matter of his earthly home entirely, choosing instead to emphasize his heavenly origins. "I have not come here on my own. The one who sent me is true, and he you do not know. But I know him. I am from him. He is the one who sent me. John chapter 7, verses 1 through 29. Such statements are commonplace in John, the last of the four canonized Gospels, composed between 100 and 120 CE. John shows no interest at all in Jesus' physical birth, though even he acknowledges that Jesus was a Nazarene. In John's view, Jesus is an eternal being, the Logos, who was with God from the beginning of time, the primal force through whom all creation sprang and without whom nothing came into being. A similar lack of concern about Jesus' earthly origins can be found in the first gospel, Mark, written just after 70 CE. Mark's focus is kept squarely on Jesus' ministry. He is uninterested either in Jesus' birth or, perhaps surprisingly, in Jesus' resurrection, as he writes nothing at all about either event. The early Christian community appears not to have been particularly concerned about any aspect of Jesus' life before the launch of his ministry. Stories about his birth and childhood are conspicuously absent from the earliest written documents. The Q material, which was compiled around 50 CE, makes no mention of anything that happened before Jesus' baptism by John the Baptist. The letters of Paul, which make up the bulk of the New Testament, are wholly detached from any event in Jesus' life save his crucifixion and resurrection, though Paul does mention the Last Supper. But as interest in the person of Jesus increased after his death, an urgent need arose among some in the early Christian community to fill in the gaps of Jesus' early years, and in particular, to address the matter of his birth in Nazareth, which seems to have been used by his Jewish detractors to prove that Jesus could not possibly have been the Messiah, at least not according to the prophecies. Some kind of creative solution was required to push back against this criticism, some means to get Jesus' parents to Bethlehem so that he could be born in the same city as David. For Luke, the answer lies in a census. In those days, he writes, there came a decree from Caesar Augustus that the entire Roman world should be registered. This was the first registration to take place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. Everyone went to his own town to be registered. Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the city of David. Then, in case his readers may have missed the point, Luke adds, because Joseph belonged to the house and the lineage of David. Luke chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. Luke is right about one thing and one thing only. 10 years after the death of Herod the Great, in the year 6 CE, when Judea officially became a Roman province, the Syrian governor Quirinius did call for a census to be taken of all the people, property, and slaves in Judea, Samaria, and Idumea, not the entire Roman world, as Luke claims, and definitely not Galilee, where Jesus' family lived. Luke is also wrong to associate Quirinius' census in 6 CE with the birth of Jesus, which most scholars place closer to 4 BCE, the year given in the Gospel of Matthew. However, because the sole purpose of a census was taxation, Roman law assessed an individual's property in the place of residence, not in the place of one's birth. There is nothing written in any Roman document of the time, and the Romans were quite adept at documentation, particularly when it came to taxation, to indicate otherwise. Luke's suggestion that the entire Roman economy would periodically be placed on hold as every Roman subject was forced to uproot himself and his entire family in order to travel great distances to the place of his father's birth, and then wait there, patiently, perhaps for months, for an official to take stock of his family and his possessions, which in any case he would have left behind in his place of residence, is, in a word, preposterous. What is important to understand about Luke's infancy narrative is that his readers, still living under Roman dominion, would have known that Luke's account of Quirinius' census was factually inaccurate. Luke himself, writing a little more than a generation after the events he describes, knew that what he was writing was technically false. This is an extremely difficult matter for modern readers of the Gospels to grasp, but Luke never meant for his story about Jesus' birth at Bethlehem to be understood as historical fact. Luke would have had no idea what we in the modern world even mean when we say the word history. The notion of history as a critical analysis of observable and verifiable events in the past is a product of the modern age. It would have been an altogether foreign concept to the gospel writers, for whom history was not a matter of uncovering facts, but of revealing truths. The readers of Luke's gospel, like most people in the ancient world, did not make a sharp distinction between myth and reality. The two were intimately tied together in their spiritual experience. That is to say, they were less interested in what actually happened than in what it meant. It would have been perfectly normal, indeed expected, for a writer in the ancient world to tell tales of gods and heroes whose fundamental facts would have been recognized as false, but whose underlying message would be seen as true. Hence Matthew's equally fanciful account of Jesus' flight into Egypt, ostensibly to escape Herod's massacre of all the sons born in and around Bethlehem in a fruitless search for the baby Jesus, an event for which there exists not a shred of corroborating evidence in any chronicle or history of the time, whether Jewish, Christian, or Roman, a remarkable fact considering the many chronicles and narratives written about Herod the Great, who was, after all, the most famous Jew in the whole of the Roman Empire. The king of the Jews, no less. As with Luke's account of Quirinius's census, Matthew's account of Herod's massacre was not intended to be read as what we would now consider history, certainly not by his own community, who would surely have remembered an event as unforgettable as the massacre of its own sons. Matthew needs Jesus to come out of Egypt for the same reason he needs him to be born in Bethlehem, to fulfill the scattered prophecies left behind by his ancestors for him and his fellow Jews to decipher, to place Jesus in the footsteps of the kings and prophets who came before him, and, most of all, to answer the challenge made by Jesus' detractors that this simple peasant who died without fulfilling the single most important of the messianic prophecies, the restoration of Israel, was in fact the Anointed One. The problem faced by Matthew and Luke is that there is simply no single cohesive prophetic narrative concerning the Messiah in the Hebrew Scriptures. The passage from the Gospel of John quoted before is a perfect example of the general confusion that existed among the Jews when it came to the messianic prophecies. For even as the scribes and teachers of the law confidently proclaimed that Jesus could not be the Messiah because he is not, as the prophecies demand, from Bethlehem, others in the crowd argued that the Nazarene could not be the Messiah because the prophecies say, quote, "When the Messiah comes, no one will know where he is from." John 7:27. The truth is that the prophecies say both things. In fact, were one to take the advice given to the festival crowd by the skeptical Pharisee and, quote, "look into it," one would discover a host of contradictory prophecies about the Messiah, collected over hundreds of years by dozens of different hands. A great many of these prophecies are not even actually prophecies. Prophets such as Micah, Amos, and Jeremiah, who appear to be predicting the coming of a future salvific character from the line of King David that would one day restore Israel to its former glory, are in fact making veiled criticisms of their current king and the present order, which the prophets imply have fallen short of the Davidic ideal. There is, however, one thing about which all the prophecies seem to agree. The Messiah is a human being, not divine. Belief in a divine Messiah would have been anathema to everything Judaism represents, which is why, without exception, every text in the Hebrew Bible dealing with the Messiah presents him as performing his messianic functions on earth, not in heaven. So then, if you wish to fit your preferred messianic candidate into this jumbled prophetic tradition, you must first decide which of the many texts, oral traditions, popular stories, and folktales you want to consider. How you answer that question depends largely on what it is you want to say about your Messiah. Matthew has Jesus flee to Egypt to escape Herod's massacre not because it happened, but because it fulfills the words of the prophet Hosea. "Out of Egypt I have called my son." Hosea chapter 11, verse 1. The story is not meant to reveal any fact about Jesus. It is meant to reveal this truth, that Jesus is the new Moses, who survived Pharaoh's massacre of the Israelites' sons and emerged from Egypt with a new law from God. Luke places Jesus' birth in Bethlehem not because it took place there, but because of the words of the prophet Micah, "And you, Bethlehem, from you shall come to me a ruler in Israel," Micah chapter 5, verse 2. Luke means that Jesus is the new David, the king of the Jews, placed on God's throne to rule over the promised land. Simply put, the infancy narratives in the Gospels are not historical accounts, nor were they meant to be read as such. They are theological affirmations of Jesus' status as the anointed of God, the descendant of King David, the promised Messiah. That Jesus, the eternal Logos from whom creation sprang, the Christ who sits at the right hand of God, you will find swaddled in a filthy manger in Bethlehem, surrounded by simple shepherds and wise men bearing gifts from the east. But the real Jesus, the poor Jewish peasant who was born sometime between 4 BCE and 6 CE in the rough and tumble Galilean countryside, look for him in the crumbling mud and loose brick homes tucked within the windswept hamlet of Nazareth. Chapter 4. The Fourth Philosophy. Here is what we know about Nazareth at the time of Jesus' birth. There was little there for a woodworker to do. That is, after all, what tradition claims was Jesus' occupation, a tecton, a woodworker or builder. Though it bears mentioning that there is only one verse in the whole of the New Testament in which this claim is made of him, Mark chapter 6, verse 3. If that claim is true, then as an artisan and day laborer, Jesus would have belonged to the lowest class of peasants in first century Palestine, just above the indigent, the beggar, and the slave. The Romans used the term tecton as slang for any uneducated or illiterate peasant, and Jesus was very likely both. Illiteracy rates in first century Palestine were staggeringly high, particularly for the poor. It is estimated that nearly 97% of the Jewish peasantry could neither read nor write, a not unexpected figure for predominantly oral societies, such as the one in which Jesus lived. Certainly the Hebrew scriptures played a prominent role in the lives of the Jewish people, but the overwhelming majority of Jews in Jesus' time would have had only the most rudimentary grasp of Hebrew, barely enough to understand the scriptures when they were read to them at the synagogue. Hebrew was the language of the scribes and scholars of the law, the language of learning. Peasants like Jesus would have had enormous difficulty communicating in Hebrew, even in its colloquial form, which is why much of the scriptures had been translated into Aramaic, the primary language of the Jewish peasantry, the language of Jesus. It is possible that Jesus had some basic knowledge of Greek, the lingua franca of the Roman Empire. Ironically, Latin was the language least used in the lands occupied by Rome. Enough, perhaps, to negotiate contracts and deal with customers, but certainly not enough to preach. The only Jews who could communicate comfortably in Greek were the Hellenized Herodian elite, the priestly aristocracy in Judea, and the more educated diaspora Jews, not the peasants and day laborers in Galilee. Whatever languages Jesus may have spoken, there is no reason to think he could read or write in any of them, not even Aramaic. Luke's account of the 12-year-old Jesus standing in the temple of Jerusalem, debating the finer points of the Hebrew scriptures with rabbis and scribes, or his narrative of Jesus at the non-existent synagogue in Nazareth, reading from the Isaiah scroll to the astonishment of the Pharisees, are both fabulous concoctions of the evangelist's own devising. Jesus would not have had access to the kind of formal education necessary to make Luke's account even remotely credible. There were no schools in Nazareth for peasant children to attend. What education Jesus did receive would have come directly from his family, and, considering his status as an artisan and day laborer, it would have been almost exclusively focused on learning the trade of his father and his brothers. That Jesus had brothers is, despite the Catholic doctrine of his mother Mary's perpetual virginity, virtually indisputable. It is a fact attested to repeatedly by both the Gospels and the letters of Paul. Even Josephus references Jesus' brother James, who would become the most important leader of the early Christian church after Jesus' death. There is no rational argument that can be made against the notion that Jesus was part of a large family that included at least four brothers who are named in the Gospels, James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas, and an unknown number of sisters who, while mentioned in the Gospels, are unfortunately not named. Far less is known about Jesus' father, Joseph, who quickly disappears from the Gospels after the infancy narratives. The consensus is that Joseph died while Jesus was still a child, but there are those who believe that Joseph never actually existed, that he was a creation of Matthew and Luke, the only two evangelists who mention him, to account for a far more contentious creation, the virgin birth. On the one hand, the fact that both Matthew and Luke recount the virgin birth in their respective infancy narratives, despite the belief that they were completely unaware of each other's work, indicates that the tradition of the virgin birth was an early one, perhaps predating the first gospel, Mark. On the other hand, outside of Matthew and Luke's infancy narratives, the virgin birth is never even hinted at by anyone else in the New Testament. Not by the evangelist John, who presents Jesus as an otherworldly spirit without earthly origins, nor by Paul, who thinks of Jesus as literally God incarnate. That absence has led to a great deal of speculation among scholars over whether the story of the virgin birth was invented to mask an uncomfortable truth about Jesus' parentage, namely, that he was born out of wedlock. This is, in actuality, an old argument, one made by opponents of the Jesus movement from its earliest days. The second century writer Celsus recounts a scurrilous story he claims to have heard from a Palestinian Jew that Jesus' mother was impregnated by a soldier named Panthera. Celsus' story is so clearly polemical that it cannot be taken seriously. However, it does indicate that less than 100 years after Jesus' death, rumors about his illegitimate birth were already circulating throughout Palestine. Such rumors may have been current even in Jesus' lifetime. When Jesus first begins preaching in his hometown of Nazareth, he is confronted with the murmuring of neighbors, one of whom bluntly asks, "Is this not Mary's son?" Mark chapter 6, verse 3. This is an astonishing statement, one that cannot be easily dismissed. Calling a firstborn Jewish male in Palestine by his mother's name, that is, Jesus bar Mary instead of Jesus bar Joseph, is not just unusual, it is egregious. At the very least, it is a deliberate slur with implications so obvious that later redactions of Mark were compelled to insert the phrase, "son of the carpenter and Mary," into the verse. An even more contentious mystery about Jesus involves his marital status. Although there is no evidence in the New Testament to indicate whether Jesus was married, it would have been almost unthinkable for a 30-year-old Jewish male in Jesus' time not to have a wife. Celibacy was an extremely rare phenomenon in first century Palestine. A handful of sects, such as the aforementioned Essenes and another called the Therapeutae, practiced celibacy, but these were quasi-monastic orders. They not only refused to marry, they completely divorced themselves from society. Jesus did nothing of the sort. Yet while it may be tempting to assume that Jesus was married, one cannot ignore the fact that nowhere in all the words ever written about Jesus of Nazareth, from the canonical Gospels to the Gnostic Gospels to the letters of Paul, or even the Jewish and pagan polemics written against him, is there ever any mention of a wife or children. In the end, it is simply impossible to say much about Jesus' early life in Nazareth. That is because before Jesus was declared Messiah, it did not matter what kind of childhood a Jewish peasant from an insignificant hamlet in Galilee may or may not have had. After Jesus was declared Messiah, the only aspects of his infancy and childhood that did matter were those that could be creatively imagined to buttress whatever theological claims one was trying to make about Jesus' identity as Christ. For better or worse, the only access one can have to the real Jesus comes not from the stories that were told about him after his death, but rather from the smattering of facts we can gather from his life as part of a large Jewish family of woodworkers/builders struggling to survive in the small Galilean village of Nazareth. The problem with Nazareth is that it was a city of mud and brick. Even the most elaborate buildings, such as they were, would have been constructed of stone. There were wooden beams in the roofs, and surely the doors would have been made of wood. A handful of Nazareans may have been able to afford wooden furniture, a table, some stools, and perhaps a few could have owned wooden yokes and plows with which to sow their meager plots of land. But even if one considers tecton to mean an artisan who deals in any aspect of the building trades, the 100 or so impoverished families of a modest and utterly forgettable village such as Nazareth, most of whom themselves lived barely above subsistence level, could in no way have sustained Jesus' family. As with most artisans and day laborers, Jesus and his brothers would have had to go to bigger towns or cities to ply their trade. Fortunately, Nazareth was just a day's walk from one of the largest and most affluent cities in Galilee, the capital city, Sepphoris. Sepphoris was a sophisticated urban metropolis, as rich as Nazareth was poor. Whereas Nazareth had not a single paved road, the roads in Sepphoris were wide avenues surfaced with polished slabs of stone and lined with two-story homes boasting open courtyards and private rock-cut cisterns. The Nazareans shared a single public bath. In Sepphoris, two separate aqueducts merged in the center of the city, providing ample water to the large, lavish baths and public latrines that served nearly the entire population of some 40,000 inhabitants. There were Roman villas and palatial mansions in Sepphoris, some covered in colorful mosaics featuring sprightly nudes hunting fowl, garlanded women bearing baskets of fruit, young boys dancing and playing musical instruments. A Roman theater in the center of town seated 4,500 people, while an intricate web of roads and trade routes connected Sepphoris to Judea and the rest of the towns of Galilee, making the city a major hub of culture and commerce. Although Sepphoris was a predominantly Jewish city, as evidenced by the synagogues and ritual bathhouses that have been unearthed there, these were a wholly different class of Jews than those found in much of Galilee. Rich, cosmopolitan, deeply influenced by Greek culture, and surrounded by a panoply of races and religions, the Jews of Sepphoris were the product of the Herodian social revolution, the nouveau riche who rose to prominence after Herod's massacre of the old priestly aristocracy. The city itself had been a major landmark for years. After Jerusalem, it is the most frequently mentioned city in rabbinic literature. Sepphoris served as the administrative center of Galilee throughout the Hasmonean dynasty. During the reign of Herod the Great, it became a vital military outpost where weapons and war provisions were stored. However, it was not until Herod's son Antipas, the fox, chose it as the royal seat of his tetrarchy, probably sometime around the turn of the first century CE, that the stalwart city of Sepphoris became known throughout Palestine as the Ornament of Galilee. Like his father, Antipas had a passion for large-scale building projects, and in Sepphoris he found a blank slate upon which to design a city in his own image. That is because when Antipas arrived at Sepphoris with a cohort of Roman soldiers in tow, the city was no longer the central hub of Galilee it had been under his father's rule. It was a still smoldering heap of ash and stone, a victim of Roman retribution for the rebellions that had broken out across Palestine in the wake of Herod the Great's death in 4 BCE. When Herod died, he left behind far more than a seething populace eager to exact revenge on his friends and allies. He also left a mob of jobless poor who had flooded into Jerusalem from the rural villages to build his palaces and theaters. Herod's monumental building spree, and especially his temple expansion project, had employed tens of thousands of peasants and day laborers, many of whom had been driven off their land by drought or famine, or, often enough, by the malevolent persistence of the debt collector. But with the end of the building boom in Jerusalem, and the completion of the temple shortly before Herod's death, these peasants and day laborers suddenly found themselves unemployed and cast out of the holy city to fend for themselves. As a result of the mass rustication, the countryside once again became a hotbed of revolutionary activity, just as it had been before Herod was declared king. It was around this time that a new and far more fearsome group of bandits arose in Galilee, led by a magnetic teacher and revolutionary known as Judas the Galilean. The traditions say that Judas was the son of the famed bandit chief Hezekiah, the failed Messiah whom Herod had captured and beheaded 40 years earlier as part of his campaign to clear the countryside of the bandit menace. After Herod's death, Judas the Galilean joined forces with a mysterious Pharisee named Zadok to launch a wholly new independence movement that Josephus terms the Fourth Philosophy, so as to differentiate it from the other three philosophies, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. What set the members of the Fourth Philosophy apart from the rest was their unshakable commitment to freeing Israel from foreign rule, and their fervent insistence, even unto death, that they would serve no lord save the one God. There was a well-defined term for this type of belief, one that all pious Jews, regardless of their political stance, would have recognized and proudly claimed for themselves. Zeal. Zeal implied a strict adherence to the Torah and the law, a refusal to serve any foreign master, to serve any human master at all, and an uncompromising devotion to the sovereignty of God. To be zealous for the Lord was to walk in the blazing footsteps of the prophets and heroes of old, men and women who tolerated no partner to God, who would bow to no king save the king of the world, and who dealt ruthlessly with idolatry and with those who transgressed God's law. The very land of Israel was claimed through zeal, for it was the zealous warriors of God who cleansed it of all foreigners and idolaters, just as God demanded. Whoever sacrifices to any god but the Lord alone shall be utterly annihilated. Exodus chapter 22, verse 20. Many Jews in first century Palestine strove to live a life of zeal, each in his or her own way. But there were some who, in order to preserve their zealous ideals, were willing to resort to extreme acts of violence if necessary, not just against the Romans and the uncircumcised masses, but against their fellow Jews, those who dared submit to Rome. They were called zealots. These zealots should not be confused with the zealot party that would arise 60 years later, after the Jewish revolt in 66 CE. During Jesus' lifetime, zealotry did not signify a firm sectarian designation or political party. It was an idea, an aspiration, a model of piety inextricably linked to the widespread sense of apocalyptic expectation that had seized the Jews in the wake of the Roman occupation. There was a feeling, particularly among the peasants and the pious poor, that the present order was coming to an end, that a new and divinely inspired order was about to reveal itself. The kingdom of God was at hand. Everyone was talking about it. But God's reign could only be ushered in by those with the zeal to fight for it. Such ideas had existed long before Judas the Galilean came along. But Judas was perhaps the first revolutionary leader to fuse banditry and zealotry into a single revolutionary force, making resistance to Rome a religious duty incumbent on all Jews. It was Judas's fierce determination to do whatever it took to free the Jews from foreign rule and cleanse the land in the name of Israel's God that made the Fourth Philosophy a model of zealous resistance for the numerous apocalyptic revolutionaries who would, a few decades later, join forces to expel the Romans from the Holy Land. In 4 BCE, with Herod the Great dead and buried, Judas and his small army of zealots made a daring assault on the city of Sepphoris. They broke open the city's royal armory and seized for themselves the weapons and provisions that were stored inside. Now fully armed and joined by a number of sympathetic Sepharians, the members of the Fourth Philosophy launched a guerrilla war throughout Galilee, plundering the homes of the wealthy and powerful, setting villages ablaze, and meting out the justice of God upon the Jewish aristocracy and those who continued to pledge their loyalty to Rome. The movement grew in size and ferocity throughout the following decade of violence and instability. Then, in the year 6 CE, when Judea officially became a Roman province and the Syrian governor Quirinius called for a census to tally, register, and properly tax the people and property in the newly acquired region, the members of the fourth philosophy seized their opportunity. They used the census to make a final appeal to the Jews to stand with them against Rome and fight for their freedom. The census, they argued, was an abomination. It was affirmation of the slavery of the Jews. To be voluntarily tallied like sheep was, in Judas's view, tantamount to declaring allegiance to Rome. It was an admission that the Jews were not the chosen tribe of God, but the personal property of the emperor. It was not the census itself that so enraged Judas and his followers. It was the very notion of paying any tax or tribute to Rome. What more obvious sign was needed of the subservience of the Jews? The tribute was particularly offensive, as it implied that the land belonged to Rome, not God. Indeed, the payment of tribute became for the zealots a test of piety and allegiance to God. Simply put, if you thought it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar, then you were a traitor and apostate. You deserved to die. Inadvertently helping Judas's cause was the bumbling high priest at the time, a Roman lackey named Joazar, who happily went along with Quirinius's census and encouraged his fellow Jews to do the same. The collusion of the high priest was all the proof Judas and his followers needed that the temple itself had been defiled and must be forcibly rescued from the sinful hands of the priestly aristocracy. As far as Judas's zealots were concerned, Joazar's acceptance of the census was his death warrant. The fate of the Jewish nation depended on killing the high priest. Zeal demanded it. Just as the sons of Mattathias showed zeal for the law by killing those Jews who sacrificed to any but God, just as Josiah, king of Judah, butchered every uncircumcised man in his land because of his zeal for the Mighty One, so now must these zealots turn back the wrath of God upon Israel by ridding the land of treasonous Jews like the high priest. It is clear from the fact that the Romans removed the high priest Joazar from his post not long after he had encouraged the Jews to obey the census that Judas won the argument. Josephus, who has very little positive to say about Judas the Galilean, he calls him a sophist, a pejorative that to Josephus signifies a troublemaker, a disturber of the peace, a deceiver of the young. Note somewhat cryptically that Joazar was overpowered by the argument of the zealots. Josephus's problem with Judas seems not to have been his sophistry or his use of violence, but rather what he derisively calls Judas's, quote, royal aspirations. What Josephus means is that in fighting against the subjugation of the Jews and preparing the way for the establishment of God's reign on earth, Judas, like his father Hezekiah before him, was claiming for himself the mantle of the Messiah, the throne of King David. And, like his father before him, Judas would pay the price for his ambition. Not long after he led the charge against the census, Judas the Galilean was captured by Rome and killed. As retribution for having given up its arms to Judas's followers, the Romans marched to Sepphoris and burned it to the ground. The men were slaughtered, the women and children auctioned off as slaves. More than 2,000 rebels and sympathizers were crucified en masse. A short time later, Herod Antipas arrived and immediately set to work transforming the flattened ruins of Sepphoris into an extravagant royal city fit for a king. Jesus of Nazareth was likely born the same year that Judas the Galilean, Judas the failed Messiah, son of Hezekiah, the failed Messiah, rampaged through the countryside, burning with zeal. He would have been about 10 years old when the Romans captured Judas, crucified his followers, and destroyed Sepphoris. When Antipas began to rebuild Sepphoris in earnest, Jesus was a young man ready to work in his father's trade. By then, practically every artisan and day laborer in the province would have poured into Sepphoris to take part in what was the largest restoration project of the time, and one can be fairly certain that Jesus and his brothers, who lived a short distance away in Nazareth, would have been among them. In fact, from the time he began his apprenticeship as a tecton, to the day he launched his ministry as an itinerant preacher, Jesus would have spent most of his life not in the tiny hamlet of Nazareth, but in the cosmopolitan capital of Sepphoris, a peasant boy in a big city. 6 days a week, from sunup to sundown, Jesus would have toiled in the royal city, building palatial houses for the Jewish aristocracy during the day, returning to his crumbling